All right, hello everyone. Let's begin. Thanks for coming to this talk, the first one of the ApacheCon and the first one after lunchtime. So this is actually the first time I present this deck. So love to get more feedback, be more interactive, and I'm glad you guys are here. So my name is Simon. I started, maybe I'll start by introducing myself a little bit more. I started off as a software developer programmer when I was 14. At that time, I was building like Linux, Unix, chat, newsgroup, things with C++, with Linux-y, Network-y, and stuff like that. Fascinated about programming at that time. Heard about Apache and all this, Apache HTTP and all those technology was like make me excited when I was a teenager. And afterward, I went to college, university, and then I started a few companies, mainly in the consumer space, social network, resume analysis, and news recommendation sites. So a lot of the companies, we built products that utilized AI technologies. Nowadays, or back then, people call it AI. In between, not many people used the word AI, but essentially, we're talking about the same thing, like natural language processing, image recognition, text, classification, recommendations, things like that. After the startups, some failed, some succeeded, I went on to do some machine learning research in London, in University College London. And there I work in a number of companies as a machine learning researcher. So moving from developers to product builder and then to research, it was kind of different, but also in the same similar area. And 3 years ago, I started a company called Prediction.io in London, moved to California. The company got acquired by Salesforce, and we donated the open source versions of Prediction.io to Apache Foundation. It's become Apache Prediction.io. It's an open source machine learning server, and I'm working at Salesforce right now in the Salesforce Einstein AI ecosystem. So a little bit background about myself. And this talk is really not about a software. So there are a lot of talks about the Apache software. This morning I presented one about Apache Prediction.io. Later I'll also have another talk about Apache Prediction.io. But this talk is a little bit special. You can see it as a summary of what I have learned in the past decades or so, building products, using technologies, doing research around AI, around machine learning. And there are really a lot of challenges in building machine learning, building AI applications, and deploy them into production environment. So this talk, I borrowed the name from a famous book, Crossing the Chasm, meaning it is a business book about bringing disruptive products to the majority market. So you can easily start from the early market, and there's a chasm in between. How you can jump from the early market to majority market, so to become a mainstream product. So that's what the book is about. So why am I using a similar title for the talk? What is the AI chasm? In the past few years, I see a lot of developers, data scientists, working really hard in the area, doing a lot of exciting stuff. Like you see new technologies, new algorithms coming out. You see blog posts about, hey, we have find a better way to do recommendation. We find a way to do music recommendation. We have find a way to predict cancer. We have find a way to classify text, deep learning, a lot of exciting stuff going on in the right, your left-hand side. Which is exciting, like algorithm that seems to work. But unfortunately, we actually need to move beyond that stage. And now you see more people doing cool demos. Like we can do a chatbot demo. The reason why they call it demo is because it's not yet production ready. So a lot of companies doing this kind of cool applications demo. But in order to move AI to the higher value chain, to offer more values to customers, you actually need to cross a quite deep and broad AI chasms so that you can start to deploy this kind of AI application solutions on productions in scale. The next stage is really the system need to learn. Like you can do a lot of research with data sets offline claiming that it can learn. But at the end of the day, if you need to learn from productions, it is not that easy. And moving forward, AI research, demo, application is great. But at the end of the day, it's about customers. You're building the products for users. They need to actually see the value. They need to interact with the applications. So this is what I call the AI chasm. It's about moving what we're building from just some algorithms that works, demos that you run on your laptop, to really deploy it to the world. And we'll see a number of challenges in the chasm. So now let's do a very quick review of what is machine learning for AI. Essentially, machine learning is the technology, one of the main technologies behind so-called AI is about learning from data without explicitly programmed. The two main parts here, one is training a model. You need a predictive model. First of all, you need training data. Text, image, activities, user records, all kind of data. Not only do you need data, but you also need labels. Labels is a term used in machine learning. Basically, that's the outcome you want to predict. Now you have the training data. So let's say you have a text document. Label is saying this text document is important or not important. Let's say that's what you want to predict. So the label is important or not important. The training data is the text itself. Now when you train the model, you go through the feature engineering process to convert that document into some machine learning model's readable factors or features. So you have a feature engineering process. And with all kinds of machine learning algorithms, then you produce a predictive model. So that's a really, really high level view of what is in the supervised machine learning space. And now you have a model. Next time you have a new document, you can input the new document, do the same feature engineering, input it to the model, and the model will be able to tell you, is this document important or is this document not important? So that's what machine learning, AI, a lot of times is about, is classification, voice recognitions, recommendations, all this. It's about making predictions or predicting the unknown. Now, it can be very easy to say that nowadays, basically every developer can build machine learning applications. Just go to your online course, read the blog post, read the documents of one of the Apache machine learning projects. This is the classic textbook tutorial. You read the data set, you train the model with some parameters, you get the model out, and now with the model you make a for loop or whatever loop and make a bunch of predictions. That's machine learning. That's easy. That's the end of the talk. Thank you. Now, so we're talking about learning from a static data set in a lab environment, one time, manually. That's what we see people doing it again and again. Even in some high-profile competitions, like Kaggle competitions, for example, they give you a nice, huge, big data set. You process it. You use big data solutions, tools to process them, build a model, run a bunch of predictions, get the score. That's it. That's what the textbook shows you. But what we really, really need to the main challenge in the world, what you really, really need when you deploy AI applications in real world is you need an application that's learning from new user-generated data on production continuously and automatically. Now, this is very scary. We're putting a lot of scary words together in one sentence, and we call it the AI chasm. This is a brutal reality, unfortunately. And that's why you see so many companies, even though they have huge research departments, they sometimes don't deploy so many intelligence applications on the market because of this. So I'm going to talk about the technical challenge as well as the product challenges separately, because sometimes we mix them together is kind of confusing, but I think it's better just to look at it from two different perspectives today. So the first challenge is because you're learning from new user-generated data, so you need to collect a lot of new training data. Now we're moving from the textbook case, handling a huge cleansed static CSV file, to growing data. Like, you're collecting data, And Apache community is actually very good at it. We have Apache Kafka, we have HBase, we have Zeppelin to look at the big data that you have collected. You have Flame to, or Kafka, whatever you want to choose. And Amazon and other hosting infrastructure provide a lot of solutions. So that's actually what you need to do, or you need to look at when you're trying to handle growing data. The second thing is, because the data is sometimes user-generated, or they're collecting in real-world environment, there are a lot of missing or inaccurate data. Some company, enterprise companies, for example, not to name the companies because I work at one of them, enterprise solutions, right? You basically relied on users to provide you with data, like be it the salespeople or be it the customers, customer service. You need to collect all the data to train the model. But if the data is not correct, collected accurately, or there's maybe some missing information, it affects your model. So this is one thing you need to handle when you're doing the modeling. Missing label is another one. In order for AI applications to learn, you need to feed it with correct answer continuously. Meaning it's like, I give you a text document, the engine, the model say it is important. But is it really important? Is it not important? Who is responsible for giving that feedback to the applications, to your algorithms? So sometimes it can be built in the user interface. Like there's some products to say, I disagree with these suggestions, I agree with these suggestions. Sometimes you just need to spend extra efforts. And there are a bunch of solutions on the market already, like Mechanical Turk, Cloudflowers, stuff like that. Basically, you outsource or crowdsource the need to label this. Like you have a bunch of people look at the data manually so that they can give you the more accurate answers to train the model. So this is some of the technical challenge about actually how do you collect new training data. And every time we talk about the challenge of AI machine learning development, we can't get away without mentioning the Netflix story, right? Anyone here work for Netflix? Not really. Okay. So they spend $1 million in the competitions. They have a winner in the competitions. And at the end of the day, they never use that winning algorithm. Mainly two parts. One is they said it on the blog post. One is they can't justify the engineering cost or engineering efforts to put that algorithms onto productions. The other one is more the product size. They shift the personalization or the prediction needs, basically. So even though you have the best algorithm, but hey, we change what we need. So the algorithm cannot adapt to the need. So this is just a big reminder of why we're talking about all these problems today. So second point is, you also need to process a model uncertain amount of data. We talked about collecting new data. Now this time is talking about processing the data. You need to run, in order to run, build a model, you need to do a lot of analysis. You need to keep running the algorithms steps in order to build a model. So while a lot of data scientists are on the left-hand side, the skill set is really about using R, scikit-learn, TensorFlow, this kind of machine learning libraries to build algorithms that seems to work, which is great. But we see a lot of challenges. Like for example, users to prediction IO or customers and companies that we talk to, they often say, we have a working algorithm. Now what? How do we put it onto production? And also thanks to the healthy Apache community, there are actually a lot of solutions we can look at. Mihail is one of the machine learning libraries in the Apache ecosystem. And compared to maybe 3, 4, 5 years ago, Hadoop was the only MapReduce large framework for large processing things. Now we have Spark, we have Flink, we have Apex, a lot of distributed processing system for large scale computation, which is great. And not only that, we also have a layer on top of it. It's an incubated projects called Beam. And basically they try to unify all the programming language. I mean, the language to access all this infrastructure. So you don't need to learn how to program in Spark, in Flink, in Apex separately. It's a unified language for all this. And now you have the processing engines, but at the end of the day, you also need some resources management system to manage this processing nodes. So missiles, YARN, and also projects on top of it to bring these two together. And also there are some hosting solutions like Apache EML for you to dynamically allocate resources for building the model, and you can shut them down. So it's more a cost-effective way to doing it. It's really a lot of techniques that nowadays a full stack machine learning engineer or a data science team really need to care about, is the need to process huge amount of unknown amount of data. The next one is, now you have a model. In the textbooks, it would tell you to, okay, do one-off batch scoring, run the model across all the things you need to predict, catch the result, that's it. In reality though, especially in the recommendation world, there are a lot of contextual information you need to process. For example, if I need to make a recommendation, what would be the next events you want to go to? It should take into consideration of date, time, your current location, your interest, availability of the events, right? These are all the things that have to be calculated in real time and not in one batch. So we see a lot of architecture. Nowadays, they make use of the real-time serving components, such as Solr, Elastic. They used to be search system, but nowadays, a lot of people combine them with machine learning modeling systems. Say, I have a model, but I put a search layer on top of it, so you can send in a dynamic query. I will reprocess, re-rank the result using the model, but based on real-time demand, and then I generate the dynamic results to you in real time. So that's one way to solve this problem. And Apache Prediction IO, TensorFlow, we all have serving components as well. And some people don't like to rely on heavy stack, so they might want to build their own web server. After you build the model, you just build a web service layer on top of it with Fiango, Aloon, and Play things, applications like that. So it's really up to you, and there's no right or wrong choices, but that's something a lot of machine learning engineers need to handle nowadays. So the fourth point is, you need to learn continuously. Remember, the continuation is super important, which brings us to another challenge. One-off modeling is nice. We build a model, run the predictions, and throw away the model. That's easy. But how about you actually need to retrain the model again and again? Why do we need to retrain the model? Because you're collecting new data, right? So you use the data from last month to yesterday, you train the model. And today, you have new data, you retrain the model. But how do you kill the old model and upload the new one? Or how do you actually just update the model directly? It involves scheduling, of course. And of course, in Apache world, we have OZ, we have Evlo, and there are other open source projects as well for this kind of scheduling. The complexity of scheduling in our experience is, it's not just one job, it's really a bunch of jobs stacked together. Sometimes you need feature engineering, extract data. Sometimes you need the expensive computation. Sometimes you need the computation for new products or new customers. So there's a lot of complex rules. It's not just one cron job and you can do the scheduling. You actually need a workflow scheduler in order to do that. And because you're learning continuously, unless you want to manually do it, run it every day by yourself, you're talking about automating this process. And it means that you need monitoring, because things fail, unfortunately. All of the time we think, oh, we set up a schedule, it's fine, but it's not. You need monitoring. So there are a lot of tools to manage the metrics, alert you when things goes wrong in the open source world as well. At the end of the day, we need to achieve the zero downtime update, right? You update a model. When you're updating it, someone may be retrieving results from your model. So you need to make sure that they're retrieving the result from the right model, and you also need to make sure that when you're replacing the model, there's no downtime between it. So sometimes we use a load balancer on top of two models. Say like, okay, we have one model up and running, we have a new model, we deployed it. is the load balancer job to actually switch the traffic to the new one before you shut down the old one. So that's one of the many ways that we can achieve zero downtime. But this is something that you normally don't see in a machine learning tutorials or project, because it's kind of more on the data engineering, software engineering side than data science. But we see that projects fail again and again because these kind of challenges were not taken into consideration. So another interesting news recently, Microsoft created a Twitter bot, learn from user. Right? Remember, we talked about learn from user-generated data continuously and automatically. And of course, you can feed the robot with anything you like. So the last point of the technical challenge is you need to learn on production automatically. And that is something extremely scary in the software world. Because what we robust, well-trained software engineers used to is the traditional software release cycle. No matter you're using the lean process, waterfall process, we still do the same thing. We have the development stage, testing stage, staging stage, and production stage, right? You release the code from one stage to another, and you do a lot of tests, theoretically, supposedly, and then you release it on production. But what machine learning AI is telling you is, you're updating it, you're learning, your system is keep learning automatically on production. It's from production to production. We tried different ways to manage that. Some of the solution is, for example, a golden test set. Meaning it's like, for example, going back to the text classification example, we have some golden test case to say, hey, this is the document, and these are the documents, these are the labels. Every time we update the model, we will run the test to see how well the model performs. If the model performs worse than the previous one, then we might need to alert the developers, or we might need to stop updating it and see what's going on. It works in some cases. It doesn't really work that well in cases like ranking recommendations, because there's no objective truth about what is the best recommendations. So it works in more like classification, like image classifications and stuff like that is better, but some cases you just need to rely on another solution. For example, user reporting. Like from time to time you ask your customers, you ask your users how well the AI is doing. And unfortunately the problem is already on production. Some users see it, but hopefully some users are kind enough to give you feedback and you stop it right away. Version management is something we are very familiar with in the software world, like source code control, version control, right? And more people talk about it in the machine learning world nowadays, because if you think about it, it's similar. We keep producing new models like every hours, every day, or every minute, and you need to keep track of all these versions. What if one day you get an email and say, hey, your recommendation create really weird result last night? You want to be able to roll back to that model, even though the model has been updated 10 times between then and now. You want to be able to roll back to that particular model and do some testing, maybe roll back to the code as well to see what data produced that model. Is it really the problem of the model, or is it the problem of something else? So a lot more people are talking about version management for machine learning nowadays. So these are really the 5 points about the technical chasm. Why it is so difficult moving from algorithms that work, a cool demo, to actually deploy things on production with scale. Now, we're building software, we're also building product most of the time, unless you're just building pure code, which doesn't make sense. A lot of the time it's about product. So that's also the product size of the challenge, product size of the AI chasms that I want to share today. Human being is a complicated creature. Data set is just a data set. What does it really, really mean? It means that you need to interact with real customers. And when we were building products, we realized that the change in user interface affects how people interact with the model huge with huge impact. Like, for example, the way you present your result to say, this is what I suggest you to do versus this is what I predict versus I automatically do it for you is very different. Think about the products that you use today. Like, if you're looking for events, if the product automatically registers events for you, how would you feel like? Or automatically apply jobs for you, how would you feel like? So it's really about the user interface, right? How you present it. And it's also about it's also the user interface that affects the data collections. One thing is, for example, rating. You see a lot of rating application to give 1 star to 5 star. That's called explicit feedback. The problem of that is there's a lot of bias. Your 5 star may be different from his 5 star, from her 5 star. So what does it mean by 5 star? Is 1 star good or 2 star good? We don't know about it. So explicit feedback, a lot of research have shown that it creates a lot of problems. So there's a MIT research years ago who say, hey, instead of doing rating, why don't we do product comparison? So some people create some kind of innovations to improve implicit feedback. This is something you need to think about when you're designing the product. So now people don't like explicit feedback. People go back to implicit feedback. Implicit feedback means the user doesn't know he or she is giving you feedback. So like you're doing the training based on user behavior, viewing a product, purchasing something. So that's kind of like the implicit feedback. The problem with that is it is super noisy. So a lot of solutions we see is actually a combination of implicit and explicit feedback here. So the second point is you need to handle new customers. When I was doing research in the few years, I have been mainly focused on large-scale recommender system evaluation and stuff like that. And when I was reading the paper, there's a lot of disclaimers in the paper. They say, oh, we actually remove all the new customers. We actually remove all the new products. It's not part of the scope of the research to handle basically users without a lot of data. That's great. That's great for research paper. We can put it in the future work sections. But it's not the case, especially if you're working in e-commerce companies or retail companies. You can't say that I have built a great algorithm, but we don't provide recommendations for new customers. You have to handle it. So how do you handle it? There's actually a lot of non-scientific solutions you can offer. For example, for any new customers, you just recommend them with the top sales product in their regions or in the time, wherever. So, or you might be recommending the trending product. So there are a lot of solutions, simple technologies, but you can handle it really well. And now, because of this, you need to change the way you evaluate your system. Traditional scientific evaluation metrics, they focused on the average. But when you're doing your evaluation, sometimes you need to do segment evaluations. So you want to evaluate your algorithms based on, is it good for new users? How do you define new users, by the way? Is it users who have signed up for 1 day or 3 days or 5 days? That's all the things you need to consider when you're building your product and the evaluation. So it's a crashed car. The cars that we like is Tesla, Autopilot. It's great technology, auto driving, not trying to say don't ride one of these cars. The point I want to make is, in real-world applications, you need to concern about unhappy customers. The Tesla case is extreme case. I'm sure the owner is not happy about it. But in a lot of applications, even just text classifications, image recognitions, you need to understand the error toleration level of your targeted customers before you actually build the applications. So the error toleration tolerations, for example, in a search, personalized search, it's actually pretty high. Like if you're returning 20 results, you can be wrong in all the remaining 10 results as long as you're correct in the first 2 or 5. results, right? It's not the case if you're sending an email, personalized email every day with just one product recommendation. If that product recommendation goes wrong, people will just click spam or unsubscribe. So it really depends on the applications, how you design the user interface. To say, when I am rolling out the algorithms, what metrics do I use? Do I want to be on the safer side or do I want to be a more aggressive side in order to get the results? And this is something when you're building the applications, products affect your decisions. Set appropriate expectation is super important. It's similar to the user interface one. So classic questions. Is it half empty or half full? The point is not about answering the questions, but customer satisfactions on AI can be just that subjective. We've seen it many, many times. So the challenge when we're building products, talking to customers, and then go back to the companies, talk to data scientists and engineers is the language of communications. A lot of the time we'll go back and say, hey, salespeople will come to us and say, hey, tell us, show us that we have the best solution compared to our competitors. Now, data scientists come back with this graph, say, we're 0.79, the competitors are 0.7, we're better. Salespeople go back to the customer and say, we're 0.79 in this AUC, ROC diagram. Customers are like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. They have cooler demos, they have better events, they have better food in the events, they have better solutions. So we need to translate from data science evaluation metrics to something that customers actually understand. The most straightforward solutions we have seen is A/B testing. So no matter what evaluation metrics you use, at the end of the day, if you set the A/B test based on the customer's business goal, then you can easily see that one solution is better than the other one. But sometimes you can't do A/B testing. Sometimes people are just using your product, like let's say if you're building the social networks, it's newsfeed recommendations. People are thinking about how well it is doing. Or if you're doing the building a mobile app for language translations, people kind of feel like it is good or feel like it is bad. They're not doing a comprehensive evaluation based on 10,000 test data. They just want to try it and feel it is good. So there are a lot of psychological user interface that you can build on your algorithms in your applications to show that the algorithm is actually working and it's actually you're benefiting from it. And the last point of the product feedback of the product chasm is you're building the algorithms as developer, but at the same time, you're building a product that needs to deliver values to customers. One concrete example is, let's say you're building scoring, like for example, lead scoring. You have building a software for salespeople and you're building a score. And you produce a score, what does that mean? What does the score mean? Like, this potential customer it has a score 50. This potential customer has a score 51. What does that really mean? Am I gaining something? Am I discovering something new? Or is it a prediction? So what does it do to me? Should I call the customer? So that's kind of like the recommendation. Or would you send an email automatically for me when the score is changed from 35 to 41? So that's automation. A lot of the time, how you design the algorithms depends on what values you want to produce. And for example, if it's about discovery, you might need a lot more explanation. Like you want to explain why the system thinks this customer is more valuable based on previous pattern. Is it because you have made a call with the customer? Is it because of the email, certain keywords that trigger the score change? So we spend a lot of time, not in the current company, but even in other previous companies as well, is we spend months building a model. At the end of the day, we find that, oh, that's actually not what the product is for. And we need to redo the work again. Remember the Netflix story I showed earlier? The goal changed. So your algorithm is great, but it's not great for what I need. And think about this when you start building the predictive applications. At the end of the day, AI chasms going from cool demo to something that actually useful, deliver value to customers, is a change of mindset between science first and to customer first. So it's a summary of what I've learned in the past years doing products, doing developments, doing research, and now owning products again. And hopefully it's helpful for you guys. Any questions?
Yes, most of the times customers don't know the potential of the AI algorithm or machine learning algorithm. So normally we'll get a request from the customer. We want this, we want that. And we know there are a lot of alternative models we can choose for them. So these models have different dynamics, each of them. So in your opinion, I have a customer say, yeah, I want this. So what is the requirement actually I should collect from the customer, which is important for us?
Yeah, that's a great question. So thanks to the media or the news, customers always looking for the latest technologies, right? Sometimes in previous company, they just call it, hey, I want to buy deep learning. Get me deep learning. So what exactly are you looking for? It's the technologies, right? So it go back to traditional product management principle. When a customer say ABC, it might mean XYZ. The first thing is try not to start from modeling, try not to start from the algorithms. Instead, start from the user interface. Produce a user interface, and this is what we are going to produce to you. Does it make sense to you? And you can make different scenarios. If we make this prediction, does it help your life? Does it make your life easier? Does it make your life worse? If we change it this way, what is it good? So start with the product user interface before you jump into the algorithm is one quick solution. But it's a really complicated problem in general product management when customers need this and do we provide something else. So we can talk more about that later.
Yeah, so you said visualizing the problem for the customer is more important. Just tell them, okay, realize what we can provide for you in the future. So from starting from there, it will be easier for the future for the following.
Yes, and sometimes in this industry, it is quite tricky. I agree with you because you will see other companies, competitors going in and say, we use 100,000 other more signals. And the customer will feel like, remember, it's about perception. They'll feel like that's a more accurate solution. In reality, you're using 10 signals, but scientifically, that's actually a more accurate solution. But there's no definite answer. It depends on how you present your 10 signals is better than the 100,000 signals other people use.
What do you do, for example, when you got...
Thank you. What do you do, for example, when you got lazy customers? I mean, in some cases, they don't request nothing. And in the end, so you are not giving them nothing. Do you usually play with toys or something like that? Like, okay, let's see how they behave or something like that.
Are you talking about consumer products or enterprise solution product?
I'm talking mainly about internal users.
Sorry?
Internal clients and clients that are not very or very close to a day-by-day routine in which they feel comfortable, but you know that it might be better. So in these cases, what I call is the customer laziness, or the client laziness.
So people who don't see the need of intelligence solution, basically.
Yeah, they think it's fine, and they don't think about trying to make it better.
Okay.
Do you find these kind of places? Because I found them.
So usually they're not the right decision makers. Like if they, if you're selling your solutions to a group of people who are not looking for solutions, they're probably not the right decision makers you want to talk to. Maybe upper level on the chain, say. And you, at the end of the day, in that case, you really need a strong metrics to show the values of what you're doing, right? You need to, first you need to talk to the decision makers, say, is this how you measure the business performance? Are you using the time to close the deal, or are you using, for example, just an example, once you identify the major metrics that is convincing, then you work towards your solution to improve that metrics. But first, you really need to find the decision maker who cares about one metrics, and then clarify that metrics before you build your solution. If people don't want to buy any change,
you know, maybe they want to buy, but yeah. they didn't know what there is to buy.
Right.
Okay, it's like Christmas is close, so you know the TVs where you see, okay, I can buy this or another this thing. Or.
Sure. So one thing I find useful is learning from the software engineering principle. A lot of principles argue that you should build a test case before you build the applications, right? That's kind of like the extreme. Similarly applied to machine learning AI applications, you should define the metrics. We should all agree on the metrics before you build the algorithms, the solutions. I think that's basically a parallel analogy. Understand what you want to evaluate before you actually build a solution.
Thank you.
Thanks.
More questions? So a lot of predictive models will have some uncertainty in their result. And certain users are more tolerant of uncertainty than others. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts or ideas on how to balance precision, recall, and then how to depict predicted values in an application, taking that into account?
Yeah, so that's also a great question. Remember the slides talk about the error tolerance. Essentially, do you tolerate more false positive or false negatives? You need to understand that dynamic before you build the system. Some customers, for example, they need absolute predictability. Like even after you change the predictive model, they're assuming that you're not changing what was predicted in the past. In that case, I guess the best way is to choose the solutions that is predictable. Like you don't do random seed, you use a fixed seed. It might not be the best scientific solutions, but if you look at the product requirement perspective, that's the solution. So a lot of the time when you look at the AI solution that is deployed on production, they're not the most accurate solution. Like accurate meaning using the scientific evaluation, they're not the most accurate. But sometimes, for example, they need explainability. The customer needs you to explain why you make these decisions, or is the auditing requirements to explain how the models make these predictions, so there's no discrimination, there's no bias. You will need to use some very basic like decision tree models, for example, that is explainable, instead of using neural networks and other things that's more black box. So that's the trade-off. And that's the whole reason why we need to think about all these questions before we start working on machine learning development. Thanks.
The initial data set does usually have a huge impact on the final solution, doesn't it?
Yes.
So have you ever tried to like initialize or seed it with different data sets that are completely off the charts, sort of, to make it more resilient or to make it more stable against future events or whatever?
I actually hope there's more work about data set in the community. Personally, I'm really, really tired of using movie data sets to solve all the world's problems. Like if we're building customer trend prediction, we use movie lens data set. If we're using telecommunication prediction, we use movie data set. It doesn't make a lot of sense. It makes sense only if you're publishing paper. But as you said, the initial data set affects how you have a big impact on the application. So I really wish the community has stronger, better data sets for different applications. I don't have a good answer for that. I don't know the right solution. And yeah, so hopefully some people will share more data set. But it's super important if you're building it for your internal companies. Don't start with an external random data set. Start to cleanse the data, collect your own data set first. And you might realize there are a lot of missing data. It's about collecting new data, remember the point? So maybe you start from fixing the data collection in your product instead of starting from a movie data set unless you're doing movie recommendation.
Yeah, in most cases, you might not even have an initial data set, right? When you go to a customer and they have a closed database or whatever, and they don't reveal the data to the public. And you might just start with a subset of a data set. You don't know nothing about the quality. And you just start off with different data sets, and then you start training and then
right.
maybe find with a generic approach, something
sure.
generic.
There's some research area about generating synthetic data based on the statistical distribution of your original data and anonymize the data so that you can play with it. Taking a small sample set which simulate the larger population better. So there are a lot of works on this. I myself is not an expert on that, and I'm not aware of software, like any software doing it like out of the box at this moment.
There are a few data sets for synthetic data generation. So for example, Ted Dunning has a project called LogSynth for generating synthetic logs, which are synthetic data for closely mimicking what you would see in production. And I know about a few other projects that are trying to do this. Flink is trying to do this for their machine learning platform, synthetic data generation. They have some code in there already. So they can look at those projects for.
So you do statistical learning model, you trained it, and then your CEO has a favorite example. And even if you include this favorite example, it still doesn't work because your statistical approach and you cannot adjust. So what do you do?
So what is the reason for failure?
Okay, so you use statistical learning. In most cases, on average, it works well. But there's a favorite example of your company's CEO which doesn't work. So what do you do?
So you need another approach for
it. I mean, the question is maybe in some cases statistical learning is not the best. This is example.
Yeah. So again, it's the problem of understanding the solution. I mean, the problem before you apply the solution. In a lot of the cases, the best solution for one domain is not the best solution for another domain. And I guess the problem nowadays is when we approach some data science team, they're expert in one domain and they want to solve the world's problems with one particular solution, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So even in the software industry, right, we have different tools. In Apache, you have thousands of tools solving different problems. So try to be tools agnostic and look at the problem and find the solutions. And I think we time's up, sorry. But we can chat afterwards.
I want to share some experience on this question.
Okay.
Because we are using a statistical model to do on this monitoring of the oil drilling platform. And we have done a lot of experiments. It shows that because the oil industry have a strong physical domain, so statistical model only does not fit the problem itself overall, because all the machine learning and AI are data driven. So what we think is some domain knowledge add up on top of this machine learning model. So just to do some fusing or incorporate maybe on this pre-processing of data level or on the bottom fusing level, it can give some better results.
Yeah, domain expertise adding to the model.
Yes.
So if you look at the, for example, prediction out stack, we actually have a component where you can add in business logics on top of the model. As I mentioned, the business logic solution for your particular application is just as important as the model, the single algorithm that you find the best. So that's a great point. Thank you. So thank you guys for coming.